Hello, everyone. Welcome to the House of Learning podcast. It's Richard, Steve, and Angela. We're back.
Hello.
And it is Justice Round 2. We're still in the same verses in Habakkuk this week at a Jesus Church. And last week, Keithan did a really cool job of just getting some of the big picture of justice and the way that God's heart for justice calls us into being different and... these paradigms of God trying to make a people who embody something different than the ways of the world. And lots of vision. I felt like lots of vision in last week. In communities chatting a little bit about, what is God's heart? Like, how does that affect me? How does that call me to care for things differently? It's such a big topic. There's so much going on when we see God display his heart. Because that's kind of what's going. This is God being like, here's how I feel about some stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And here's what I'm going to do about it. Of course, there's lots of layers of things to learn from that.
So many layers. And whether it's Keithan's teaching or what we talked about in our community group or even last week when we sort of explored... really the breadth of God's justice. It's just been an amazing journey.
So much stuff.
Yeah.
But there's one aspect of this that I think Shelby this week is going to talk about a little bit, is that when we see God display his heart and kind of promise to do stuff about injustice, it actually comforts us. Mm. It's supposed to interact with us in a way that... spurs us on, makes us feel secure and safe in being people of justice, encourages us to align with the right things. And we, throughout Habakkuk, we've been on this journey where one of the themes is faith. I mean, that sort of middle section, the high point of Habakkuk is, the righteous will live by their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want to rehash everything we've talked about, tempting as it is, but there's something about the exercise of faith that is really important for Habakkuk to navigate the things he's navigating, for him to be able to lament in a way that leads to hope, for him and able to continue to be part of this righteous remnant that's got hope in God's ways and things like that. And so that's what we wanted to pick up a little bit today. Think about how does what God's displaying of his heart here interact with us, maybe when we are facing something ourselves or maybe observing something that others are facing. And that justice muscle that's being provoked here is sort of wants to get exercised, but we need faith to do that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're just going about justice in our own strength, which you can do. But the results will be limited compared to God's way of doing it. So we need to exercise our faith. And maybe we're just I don't know if I have faith and hope and energy from God to actually respond to what I'm seeing. So it's just two parts. We can tune our heart into the right stuff, but there's something about who God says he is and what God says he does and what he cares about that's supposed to actually... help us get up out of our seat for us to act differently or go do something on behalf of someone else. And so, a really important aspect of this, and especially reading all the rest of the prophets, so much of the prophetic literature and scripture is God basically saying, hey, here's what I see going on, here's how I feel about it. Just this insight into God's heart. So there's actually a really good pattern of reading this with these kind of questions in mind. Which is a useful way to bring a set of questions to lots of other things we read in scripture as well. So, this should be really good.
It should. And, I've been thinking a lot about that section that we looked at earlier on lament. And I mean, it's a lot, it's hard. It's hard to walk with Habakkuk lamenting and thinking about how I have been and in some ways still am in a season of lament, but coming out of it and then And then now here we are hit with some woes. And like what I learned in the lament part was there's hope because of who God is. And in this new part, like there's woes kind of in other places in the Bible too, in the prophets, but reading this woe section with understanding God's heart, but then giving us a place to go with who he is saying he is in these woes. A positive takeaway from a woe is a muscle that we hope to flex today.
That's really good. Yeah, because it's really easy to like get to a woe. I mean, like the Beatitudes in the Gospels or something, like get to the woe and be like, uh-oh. You know, it's like, yeah, that's almost our reflex, it, like right. The word woe, but like, and I think it's because we're afraid of like, what if I find myself on the wrong side of the woe?
Yeah.
And that's true. And actually that's good for
it's
us
a
because
warning,
it is a warning. Mm-hmm. And if we find ourselves on the wrong side of the woe and we feel convicted, then we're like, I'm in the wrong zone. Mm. Like God's actually going to have to work for God to bring about what he wants to bring about. He's going to have to work against me. Like, I don't want to be doing that. Because not only am I like, that's not the relationship I want to have with God, but what we're going to see in the woes is if you're in the wrong zone, like a common theme in all of these woes is people like, I think I'm gaining. And God's like, nope, you're going to lose. Like it's going to, and not just because God's like, I'm going to like spitefully hurt you, but like the way that you think is of gain is actually a way of harm. Mm. You're going to harm others and harm yourself by doing this. So yeah, it is a warning, but I think we don't like warnings, right? So when we approach the woe, yeah, it's like, you know, if I said to you, hey, I mean, this is the classic thing, right? You know, like how many devotionals that you can read every morning have been entitled like God's Little Book of Promises and like all the promises of God. Yeah. Like, can you imagine bringing out like a devotional book? We should do this, by the way. This would be awesome. God's little book of woes.
Yes. No one would buy it.
Like, it would be amazing. But there is a warning. That's an aspect we might bump into as we look at these.
Yeah, convicting, but God doesn't leave us there.
Yeah.
And he always has a place to take us when he convicts us of sin. And that's the miracle of knowing Jesus is he reveals our sin, but he does something with it and he redeems us and restores us. And so as we're going through today, we're promising to link arms with each other, link arms with you. And cause it's scary to read about woes, but let's do this together in a way that, that can bring hope.
And Habakkuk's vantage point is he's one of the righteous remnant.
Yeah.
So he's not on the wrong side of the woes.
Yeah.
I'm upset about this. Mm-hmm. And this is God putting an arm around his shoulder and being like, Habakkuk, I'm upset about it too.
I see it. Mm-hmm.
You're right to be upset about this. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage you. Here's what I'm going to do about it.
Yeah.
You know, I was reflecting as you're talking, reflecting about some of the very early conversations we had about faith and as it relates to exile. And God's saying, hey, no, this is where we want to be, you need to be to flourish. And now what we've, you know, as we come to these woes, I see God almost saying, like, it's dangerous outside, being outside of my presence, and it looks ugly, and that's what these woes look like. But it's really a call to remain faithful to who he is, to this invitation to come in from exile into his presence.
Yeah.
And so that gives me a very different way of kind of looking at these.
Yes. Woes. Yeah. There's hope either way.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. The only way you read these woes without any hope is if you're like, no, I disagree with God. Like either I disagree or I know it's wrong, but I still want to do it.
Or you read them and you say, I don't see anything wrong with this. I don't know what's wrong.
And if that's where you're at, I would just say like, see one of us. We want to like have a chat. That's a dark, I don't think there's going to be many people reading things from that vantage point.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is spend just a few minutes with each one.
Sure.
Cause we've had a couple of long podcasts. So we've made a commitment to a shorter podcast today because you listened to a lot the last couple of weeks, lots of big ideas. So this is to get the juices flowing. Hopefully you can pull it into like reading and praying through this yourself and talking about it in community, things like that. So we're just going to spend a bit of time with each woe and think like, okay, what's God showing that he cares about in each one.
So there's five woes.
So there's five woes. I mean, I know it'll take a minute. Should we read? Because people, if you're listening in the car, this is kind of tricky when we're like looking at the text.
Yeah.
So maybe we should read one and then talk about it.
I like it. So let's start with...
Go on, Steve. Read the first one and then let's have a think about it.
So this is Habakkuk 2, verses 6 through 8. So it says, "Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying..." So this is the captives who are going to be taunting, the captives that he's just talked about, the people who have been offended.
Yeah.
And so God then says, "Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. Yes. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey, because you have plundered many nations. The people who are left will plunder you, for you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them."
Ah, boof. So,
yeah. Drops the mic almost, because he's got more to go. Yeah. So.
And like, it's worth recognizing that we read this, and it's this sort of like epic language of poetry, but epic in kind of scope. You know, this is like, "I'm Spartacus," you know, like big scene language, you know, like, and so we can read it and think, you know, it kind of sounds like Habakkuk on a mountain railing against the whole world kind of thing. But what we then need to do is just sort of like try to find that gear where we're like, okay, so what are the dynamics? Because as much as there's some big picture stuff, Habakkuk lived in a city where things were happening in his neighborhood, like with the businesses he dealt with his landlord, with, you know, like there was some down-to-earth grassroots realities to these big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that I think helps us catch then, like, what's God's heart being displayed in a way that I, because then if I translate, okay, what's our version of that in our world?
Yes.
It helps us think, okay, like, how does God's heart engage in language and concepts I can understand in my here and now? Because God's heart is going to be the same.
He never changes. The situation changes slightly, but I mean, it's talking about economic exploitation, extortion. I think
greed,
that's very
greed as well.
It's pretty applicable today. I think also about like the tax collectors in Jesus's day. That was a sin that they were in, doing day after day. Matthew. The financial aspect of it is a sin that transcends all of time, right? It's the commodity of money and getting it under by exploiting somebody else. So there's a power position as well.
Yeah.
The strong exploiting the weak for money.
It's like we might be greedy in a way. Like we might want to have lots of stuff. Maybe we've got a broken relationship with the idea of like security in our finances, you know, or something like that. And we just go like, we work really hard to heap stuff up. That is another conversation, but this is talking about where there's that motivation. And actually maybe it's some of that insecurity, or maybe it's something else in greed of just like, just that desire for more, to consume more, you know, to find value by having more. And like some of that brokenness is causing someone to rationalize, to justify in themselves, like actually stealing from others. So it's actually like they've got lots of gain, but it's at the expense of what is owed to other people.
Yep.
And so it's a sort of... it's someone who's lost sight of a right way to think about what's owed to me and what's owed to them, because it's almost that some just process of like working that through has got disrupted by this need to get. And so something... some sort of dynamic like that. Mm-hmm,
well, mm-hmm. And because the words he uses in here are, it's not just woe to the greedy. I think that's behind it. But look what he pulls out. These are stolen goods, yeah. Extortion, plundered, shed human blood, destroyed lands and cities. So that greed has led so far down the path of evil that it's not just a desire or a want for economic, for wealth. It's then acting upon that in a way that's been so destructive. And God's saying, no.
Yeah.
You know?
And I like the blood on their hands, like the violence kind of thing is, I'd actually think here, because violence comes up later on, so it's emphasized somewhere else, this is not so much like you stole at knife point.
Right.
But more by your economic exploitation, when that person starved to death, that blood is on your hands.
It's caused injury.
There's a ripple effect, and you are responsible. Yeah. And God does not miss that. Yeah. And he's pointing that out.
And I like the thing you emphasize as well, Angela, is like there's one of the dynamics we're going to see in all of the woes is there's an abuse of power. Mm-hmm. So you've got power. What's that power for? And it jumps to that power is for my gain. So we like almost this reflex in broken humans to use our power to benefit ourselves. And God's like wanting to put this question in between of like, and what about responsibility to others? Like, could that power be for more than just you? So this is almost, I think, selfishness is like it's really, what you do really with apparent in this stuff.
And they have free will to do what they want with the power, but there are consequences.
So what's this look like today? In our world, like what are examples of this dynamic in our world where it's like, someone could be experiencing something that's upsetting, that's hurtful, that's they can feel like this isn't fair, this is unjust. Like I think about like exploitation of workers in other countries, you know, like knowing, like did some 8-year-old child in Bangladesh stitch my clothing that I'm really glad I feel like I'm getting at a good price. That's almost like, I know that's like a kind of in vogue for us to talk about that in our culture, and that's a good thing that we're growing in that. But it's a bit like thinking, how can I be connected to this even if it's 1,000 miles away? Mm-hmm. But that's one example. It'd be nice to have an example that's like, what about if you're like next door to it?
Something that comes to mind is a hypothetical situation where somebody in a position of power in a company takes credit for or gets monetary tangible gain from something that somebody else did, or because they're over somebody, they're taking a gain that's due to somebody else in a way that's stealing.
Like they got the raise and the promotion.
Yeah, and they're not attributing it to other.
That's a really good one.
And that person, right? There's a ripple effect because that actually will cause that other person to just slide further and further down. That the person in the position of power can justify that. They absolutely could justify that, right? And God is saying in that situation, no, there's blood on your hands for this. Yeah. And I see this, even if nobody else does, I see this.
And that's really important then. Like, it's like, okay, so where's the comfort in this? Because when that happens to you, you feel unseen, unvalued, unheard. And God's like, no, these are the kind of things I see and I care about. And because I see your value, I call this stuff out as being unjust, as being unfair. And it's the sort of stuff that I work to put right.
Yes.
And so that's so important, us understanding like God's heart in those situations. That's where like Habakkuk's laments begin, right? He's almost like, God, don't you care about what's going on?
Yeah.
And Habakkuk's got to this point of interacting with God here, and he's about to sing a psalm in response to this interaction where he's like, I do have hope in God. Mm-hmm. And it's reaffirming, like, no, God does care. God really cares about this because God promises to do something about it. And that's the other twist in this is like these people, you know, they have they've abused power to take, but the way the dynamic is going to end up is that the very people who suffered at their abuse of power will be the ones who actually then, like, come knocking at the door being like, you owe us. So what's owed will get dealt with. And again, like, these woes are very, like, eschatological.
Mm-hmm.
God's not saying, like, this is going to happen next Wednesday. I'm sending some angels out. We're going to take care of it, you know, because he's already told Habakkuk, like, there's going to be judgment. There's going to be exile. There's a long journey to these things. But just reassuring Habakkuk, like, that generations may pass, but I keep account of injustice.
And you use the word eschatological. For those who don't know what that is, can you define that?
Yeah, so that's like, it's a special way of cooking an egg. Where you
it's over easy and scrambled at the same time.
Yeah, so it means like the end time. Right. So it's basically pointing to the end of the story. And I think that's one of the hard things, which actually is, that's what, in a way, Habakkuk's wrestling with. So if we imagine Habakkuk as this employee who's overlooked because their boss steals the credit, and be like, well, God, are you going to put that right? Yeah. And God be like, I see it. Like, I know it's not right. I'll deal with it. And be like, so is it going to come to light that my boss did that? Like, maybe not. But, like, in that boss's ongoing story, like, God won't lose it. And God's care for you, provision for you, and things like that, like the ongoing story of you, God won't lose sight of that, of your need, of your pain, things like this. And so...
And he will still credit it.
It's a hope of faith, and it's a comfort, not the kind of comfort that's like... I don't know, it's the difference between comfort and joy. I feel like there's a version of joy which would be like, and the boss's boss sees it and calls him on it.
Yeah, and all is made right. And it's like,
boom, all's made right. I'm woohoo, you know? But this is a kind of comfort that's like, it's not like, woohoo, you know, amazing yet. But God's caring for this. So I feel comforted because although that's what abuse of power does, it leaves me feeling totally powerless. This powerful God says, I got you. So there's some comfort in that.
And the attribute I see of God in this is this omniscient compassion, right? He sees it all, and his compassionate heart is dealing with it in his perfect timing, his sovereign plan, according to his sovereign plan. So because he's omniscient, because he's compassionate for the victim, but also the oppressor, you know, there's grace in that too. I can have hope. They can have hope. We can have hope in his plan in the midst of this, even though, and that's where faith comes in, because we won't see it immediately, but we will eventually, you know, eschatologically. It's going to come to pass that all will be made right and restored in this situation and in all situations.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to keep us moving and read the next one. Okay. Woe number two. Here we go. Actually, I should read it. I've got different versions in front of me. It's very confusing here. So this is it's the next couple of verses, 9, 10, and 11. So woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. You've plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Very, very like poignant visual here. So you've got someone who evil gain. So again, it's like getting by abuse of power. But the result of this is not just having more, but the result of this is safety. So someone has used unjust gain so that they can have safety while other people are exposed to risk and harm and suffering. So it's like feathering your own nest. I wonder whether the English idiom we have of feathering your own nest,
because I've never heard
any connection back to Habakkuk here. But and then we end up with the sort of visual that, you know, they've built this house of safety. But what God's going to do is that this person's relationship, like they almost like celebrating, rationalizing, you know, that they've built this safety for themselves. Mm-hmm. They've built their own security, but their relationship will become one where that very house they've built by unjust gain cries out and condemns them. So the thing they think's making them safe. And here's this like tragic twist of like the abuses of injustice we think we're gaining. So someone thinks they're getting safety and God's like, no, you think you're getting safety, but the end of the relationship you have with this thing you think is going to give you security is going to be that it's going to cry out in condemnation and it's going to make you feel vulnerable and weak and condemned and insecure.
And in fact, you're less safe than you ever were.
Yeah.
And ever thought you were.
A complete twist, you know? Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's our, I mean, goodness.
Examples.
Lots of modern examples here. Like the ones that come to mind.
For you? Or
no, what? I'm asking.
Oh.
I'm asking, looking at Steve, because Steve's been a bit quiet for a while, so yeah, I want to throw him
on
the
bus. I'm just taking all this in. I mean, there's a lot. I think that, you know, what strikes me about this is the, you know, it's almost the in club, the exclusivity clubs that people build that are really, and they're to the exclusion of others as well. I see this as this is not this safety that he's building is a way to extract themselves from this situation.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking a really similar thing.
Yeah.
Because there are these in clubs.
Yeah.
And it's like there's privilege and power that comes, you know, by being networked or a part or having access to something.
Mm-hmm.
But the unjust, and sometimes we have access to an opportunity and it's like, wow, I'm so privileged to have access to this opportunity. The twist here, though, is it's like, and I'm going to preserve and protect my opportunity by excluding others from having access.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's like, that's the little twist on this.
You can't get in. You don't have the key to this club.
Like you don't have the right economic background, mm-hmm. the right educational background. I mean, we're not many like years. I mean, it's still going on, but like redlining, you don't have the right skin color. You know, like there's all sorts of examples of this.
So there's class divide, racial divide, all the things in society. What are some practical everyday examples, though, that like, because it's, we can go like big picture about it, here's what's wrong with our culture.
Yeah.
Right. But is there an example that's like really convicting that just hits home? Steve's pointing to me. I'm asking you guys. I don't know.
Well, I think of is like in educational situations.
Mm-hmm.
Like it might be really easy for someone to like leverage a relationship they've got where maybe they're like a donor to a school or like they've got some position of privilege to get like preferential treatment for their kid.
Oh, that's a good one.
Right. And if you're a parent and you're like, I don't have that power. And so I'm also like, I'm sad that I don't get to like advocate for my kid the same way and get them the same opportunities. But actually what's happening, and this is kind of silly, but it's like, oh yeah, because you're friends with the president of the school or whatever, you know, your kid got to have the lead role in the play and all the opportunities to develop and get experience. And mine didn't because, and there's like something unfair about the access there. And you can feel dishonored, you know, in that way.
Well, and I would go further. It's not just that you have access, but you treasure that so much that I'm actually not going to invite you into that same access. And so now the suffering is actually our relationship crumbles.
Yeah.
Because now you have something, you know, I've intentionally protected that access for myself, not allowed you to have that.
Yeah.
And I've just set up the failure of our friendship.
Yeah. And I've got to say, this is one I've seen a lot of in churches.
Yeah.
Like I've seen churches where there is rampant nepotism.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like the pastor's kid, like, hey, who should we like get to be the new youth leader or you know, give this opportunity to, or like who do we think God's gonna use? Who do we want to honor? Who do we see opportunity for? Like who are we going to build a future for? And it's like, it's hard. There's something about us as broken humans where it's hard for us to ask those questions and genuinely be open to like what all the possibilities are.
Yeah. I mean, I see this play out in the workplace all the time. This is, you know, leadership teams that just basically surround themselves with sycophants that just kind of, you know, parrot themselves, et cetera. And you just get this, you end up getting an organization that is so one-dimensional, they just collapse.
Yeah.
You know, they aren't productive. And the very success that you were trying to ensure and protect by, you know, filling your table with everybody that says yes to you.
Yeah.
Is what kills you.
It just drowns.
It stifles. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like then when we're like, okay, so what's God's heart to people in this situation? Mm-hmm. You see this like transfer of shame and honor, affirmation and condemnation. So the people who think they're like secure, affirmed, you know, things like that, actually their end is going to be they're condemned and shamed.
Mm-hmm.
And we, like, you know, not having access, you know, our kid doesn't get the same opportunity, the workplace things, you know, we can feel shamed. And God's like, yes, I see that you've been shamed, but I will honor you.
Mm.
So like God valuing the sufferers.
And I can't help but think of the Beatitudes, you know, blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor in spirit. But, you know, the way that he sees the lowly, he honors them above those who are put themselves on a pedestal. Mm.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
So there's kind of that language implicit in here, which is really cool.
All right, Angela, you're up.
Okay.
Number three.
Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes town by injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. I'm sorry, I can't see very well. As the waters cover the sea. I read that like a second grader.
You have got an incredibly small print Bible.
I know. And I have, anyway, I'm not going to go into my eyes on this podcast, but I read it slowly so that everybody can digest it.
There we go.
Yes.
Yeah, very intentional reading.
Yes.
So this, like, front and center here, we have violence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, like, really apropos, remembering that what God's said is going to happen in the judgment is the Babylonians are going to come.
Yeah.
So this very violent nation who establish their empire, who take over towns, who, like, stamp their culture on things by violence. And they think they're building this amazing thing. And then God's like... I see the violence. I see the suffering because of violence. And you think you're building almost like a temple to your own greatness, your own power. Like you're building things that are a celebration of how you've exercised your power and how great your power is. A lot of pride in here. And God's like, no, those things that you've made that you think celebrate your power, when your power is shown to be what it is, that it's actually unjust abuse of power, those very things will become the fuel of your own suffering. They will be the fires that actually like contribute to your destruction.
I think about how in the sermon just on Sunday, when he was showing that mosaic of the blue Babylon tiles, you know, and that was very indicative of that time period and how we saw it in a museum and what that actually represented was the slave labor.
Yeah.
Also in Egypt, right? The Israelites building Pharaoh's temple. I mean, this is all over the place. Abuse of power.
I think it's really easy for us in like a more middle class setting in a suburb to think this kind of violence is like, there's not as much of it. But like gang violence is rampantly on the rise in mm-hmm. Portland.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like there's loads of violent crime. Think about a school again. Like mm-hmm. There's loads of bullying.
Yeah.
Like people face violence all the time. Think about like violent abuse in a home.
Mm.
Like someone trying to build the kind of life they want by controlling someone through violence. Mm. You know, so it could be getting gay, it could like bullying or like mugging someone because you want their money, but it can also be using violence to control someone or the threat of violence to control someone to kind of build things the way you want them to be so that they serve you. You know, they become idols of your own greatness. So I think we see lots of this in our world. And yeah, like again, it's that twist of like, the thing that when your head is in the injustice space you think is celebration worthy, when God actually reveals the reality of things, will then become the cause of tears to you. You know, it's just this, there's something tragic and upside down, something deceiving
mm-hmm.
About injustice, which is really interesting because actually there's an element of God's heart in here that's making me like have there's a woe, there's a warning against perpetrators of injustice, but there's also like a compassion of like, man, people are so deceived by injustice. It's so dark and dangerous, you know? So something in the pattern of this is just getting my thoughts going as well. And then in the middle here of the woes, because there's five, we have the sort of promise, the whole earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. So, like, God is going to put his right perspective. People will have access to and understand the right perspective as the waters cover the sea. In other words, there was the flood with Noah. This is, like, Bible pattern thing.
Right.
As the flood with Noah was to wipe out unrighteousness, and that there's a lot to get into here, but we're not going to. God is going to flood the earth with the knowledge of him, and that's actually going to cleanse and wash away the possibility of injustice. And so, yeah, just like
so good.
Very eschatological, to use that word again, like pointing forward to like what the end of this is going to be like. That's very profound.
And you mentioned this pinnacle moment in that verse. And so anytime I see the kind of the center of a section have kind of this main moment, I look at the way that this is written, it's sort of a spiral, right? So I was backing out and looking at the progression of just these, the first three woes, and each one can lead into the next one. That economic exploitation can move into now I've exploited somebody, now I'm putting myself on a pedestal and keeping out people, setting myself apart from people, keeping them away at their own demise.
Yeah.
And then the very next one, a small step is violence. We can read this violent woe and go, oh, that'll never be me, because this is the extreme version of sin. But I think part of this passage is showing that it's a slippery slope. And these steps between each of these woes of being at fault of any one of these, it's not very far. You have to slide to get to the next one. And the violence one is I think, you know, one of the worst that he's putting right next to this exaltation here.
And a great example of that, if you want to, is just like go read the life of King David with Bathsheba and Uriah. And, you know, like, oh, I would never lie. Well, no, to cover one sin, I committed a worse one. I would never murder. Oh, well, to cover the worst one, I've got to do an even worse. You know, just so there's something in that. Anyway, I'm going to read the next one.
Okay.
I'm determined. We're going to get through here. This is quite a long one to read, so bear with. Here we go.
Starting at verse 15.
Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked body. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it's your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you've done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you, for you have shed human blood. you've destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. So a bit of a complex one here, because we've got the drunkenness, the nakedness, but then we also have like the, still this idea of like abuse of power and like the causing of death in others, including the abuse of creation.
Yeah.
Of animals as well. So a very broad one. But Steve, there was something you spotted as like a big meta theme in this one that's worth drawing out that we can then think of like, what's that in our world?
Yeah, it just seems like when you, it's, if you follow what's going along, it's him who gives drink to his neighbors in order to get them drunk, or who, you know, and so what I see here is this coercion is what's happening, is trying to, you know, like to trick people to sort of steer them down this path.
Yeah. It's lying by action.
Yeah. 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 It's, you're taking advantage of things.
Yeah. And again, to get things that are maybe not the right things to get.
Yeah. But you shouldn't be
gazing at their naked bodies.
That's right.
And they don't want you to gaze at their naked. They would be ashamed. But you want it, so you're going to get it. How are you going to use your power to get it?
You're
manipulation.
You're going to trick them. You're going to deceive them.
Yeah.
I see that element in kind of all the woes too, that like calculated way of thinking, like a means to an end.
Yeah.
And that end is sinful. Yeah. It's a me focused.
And I think one of the blends we see is that some of the ends are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like you shouldn't want to just like go around gazing on everyone's nakedness. That's like a pretty obvious one.
Yeah.
Some of the ends though, like I want to feel safe.
Yeah.
I want to feel secure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so not all the ends are bad. So there's like, there's a twofold, like questioning the end and questioning the means as we sort of reflect on these. Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah.
So what's the like modern examples of this manipulation, especially where it's like manipulation to get something? I mean, just because I bumped into someone or talked to them about this week, where it's like an abusive relationship where someone's like manipulating, coercing someone, you know, and they're like, they're in that place where like, I didn't even know who I was. I didn't know what to, like, I couldn't think rightly anymore. Like I'd been confused by this person into a place where then they could control me for the things they wanted, you know? And like that, so that's an obvious one because it's just in the foreground for me, you know, like events of the week. And I think we see a lot of that, like abusive relationships, like sexually abusive relationships, things like that. Yeah. But they're the obvious ones. We see lots of like manipulation in the workplace. We see manipulation sometimes in parenting, like parenting your kids and trying to like protect them from harm. And, you know, so you use the tools that you have to do that. But now they're older and you just, you know,
I think it's
that slippery slope again.
Yeah. Exactly. I think, and it's subtle when this idea that drunkenness is brought up here. When I think of somebody who's drunk, I think of somebody who can't see clearly, right? And something's happened to them where they're altered. Their way of perceiving is altered. And so a situation where a victim can't perceive things straight, like you said, in a relationship, but I would also say in a situation where they are enamored by something so much that they're going down this slippery slope in a relationship or in a community dynamic where they don't realize the bad lifestyle that they've now found themselves in. And it started with just maybe they're really looking up to somebody. They're enamored by the security or safety or beauty of this person or this leader of this group or what they have to offer. And now they've started to adopt this lifestyle that is so far from being healthy and right and godly that they're getting destroyed. And the woe goes to the leader of this group. That's mm-hmm. what God is saying. The person who gets this person drunk, yeah. not the victim who falls into this sinful lifestyle.
Yeah, and that's so important because there is shame for the victim. Mm-hmm. The victim experiences shame, but this is part of how God sees mm-hmm. victims of injustice. Mm-hmm. And there's this exchange of shame and glory going on mm-hmm. where like the perpetrator of manipulation will end up being the one that's ashamed. And although the person experienced, the victim experiences shame, God's like, I will honor and like restore you.
Yeah.
Like to bring glory to you. Mm-hmm. So that like just knowing that God sees that shame, like God, but the shame you experience that makes you want to, I mean, like people in abusive relationships so often, like feeling guilty, talking to someone, letting someone yeah. into
feeling
the story.
Feeling like it's their fault.
Yes. So shame does that. Mm-hmm. And so like one of the, like God's heart here is actually, you know, like your shame is not going to keep me from you, but your shame is something I want to let you know I see, and I want to like grieve it with you and then restore you from it.
Yeah.
The other dynamic I see in the end here is like a ways God sees us, like people who are suffering abuse, manipulation, coercion, things like that. Look at the words in verse 17, like overwhelmed, terrified, like afraid. Like that's how you often feel when you've been manipulated and you feel trapped, you feel overwhelmed and terrified. And God's acknowledging that dynamic, that he sees that dynamic, he sees that place a victim can be in. And the perpetrator, the manipulator, will end up being the one who's actually terrified of what they've done
mm-hmm.
and is overwhelmed by what they've done.
Yeah. Mm.
So all of like the emotional weight that you're processing, the emotional pain that you experience as a victim, mm. God's saying like, I see it, I acknowledge it, and like it will not go unnoticed. Like the end of all the accounting of these things is like that will be understood. Because that is the sort of thing of like sometimes people, we want to get people safe, we want to get them thriving and flourishing, we want to get them out of an abusive situation. But they might be left with like, yeah, but what about like what happened to me? What about how that felt? So I love that there's very experiential yeah. language mm-hmm. in here as well.
Yeah. So good.
Okay, last one. Here we go.
Last one. Well, this one starts, it doesn't start with woe.
It starts with the woe's in the middle.
So starting at verse 18, it says, of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman? Or an image that teaches lies. For the one who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to the wood, come to life, or to lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. And then I love how he ends in verse 20. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I read that. I almost think that's like just wrapping up all these woes.
It definitely is. This is like the posture of learning moment. Yeah. This is language to translate it into our concept. But like, okay, for one, fingers on lips and listen.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of it's the posture of listening and learning.
I almost think like this is what Habakkuk, make sure you write this down. Yeah. Pay attention here.
Yeah. So we've got an idol. So they're crafting an idol out of wood, and they've got this hope that like now they will have access to guidance and safety, you know, that they want to connect. They know there's like, that there's more than just humanity, that there's spiritual powers, and they're trying to access, but in this really wrong-headed way. And you just get the sort of tragedy and deception of idolatry played out here. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you think you're going to get guidance, but you're going to get nothing. Like, you can ask it to come to life all you want, but there's no life in it. Like, what you've made, I mean, there's a few other psalms that talk about this as well. You know, it's like, all you've done is made something in your own image.
Yeah.
You've not tapped into, you've not tapped into Yahweh. But instead, you've made something in your own image, and you've actually opened yourself up to being deceived by the spiritual powers that want to unjustly manipulate and do you violence. So, just a real picture of the tragedy of idolatry.
Do you think this is speaking you know, just for, because I think about in modern times, well, for us, I don't think we go around carving idols. I know that happens, but in general, I think most people would say, oh, I don't do this. This isn't a problem for me. But the idols in our lives of, there's lots of other idols in our lives. And are we looking at those to in the same way to provide that comment, you know, wake up, can it give guidance? Are we looking to the idol of perhaps our education know, as a way to just say, oh,
or the news channel we love,
yeah,
because it really itches our ears, yeah, that are tuned in for something we care about.
Yeah. I mean, you can read all these other woes and check the box and go, okay, I'm good. I'm not doing any of that. I'm not violent. I'm not exploiting someone. But if you're reading this idol portion and saying, I'm good with this one, you're deceived. All of us. All of us are prone to the sin of idolatry, and it's putting in our culture ourselves ahead of God. If there's an area in your life, in my life, that we're not giving to God and praying about and seeking His wisdom, and we're leaning on our own understanding, we are putting ourselves ahead of God. Yeah. So this is a tough one, and I'm always convicted when I learn about idolatry in the Bible. What am I not leaning on God for and waiting on God for?
Yeah, a modern version of this. It's a bit oblique, but like the way we might craft our Instagram image.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we craft this idolatrous relationship with an image of ourselves that we want to project. It's our aspirational self, who we wish we were, the version of us we're going to let people see. And it can actually become an idol. We're almost like guided in our actions, not by who we really are and where we're really at. Like we lose contact with truth and self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And we start to sort of deceive ourselves by trying to create life out of an image of ourselves rather than by who we actually are and where we're actually at.
That projection is not going to affect your day-to-day.
No. Or it will in destructive ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ripple
but it's
effect.
Not going to provide real life.
No. And here's the, again, the twist is like, I think we're talking about this in a way that's like, what's the warning to us?
Yeah. Mm-mm.
But Habakkuk's perspective here is like, what's the comfort? So as you watch people, like push people to idolatry, create images that like capture people but aren't going to give them life, where you're like watching your friend tragically, like spellbound by that influencer who's not going to give them life, trapped in a dysfunctional, idolatrous relationship now, you know, like... And your sort of heart breaks because someone's like connected to something that's actually lifeless, but by pursuing that connection has disconnected themselves with the God of life. Yeah. Like where's the comfort in that? And God's like, what's dead is going to be shown to be dead. And where life really comes from is going to be shown to be me. Like it's going to be uncovered. These realizations are like, I'm going to bring that to people. Mm-hmm. And so there's like hope in God's work, like where God sees people trapped in idolatry, like God wants to do something about that. Because I think it's really easy for us to think of idolatry as like, oh, I don't want to do it. Like, woe is me if I commit the sin of idolatry. Mm-hmm. But there's also the injustice of like causing idolatry.
Yeah, causing idolatry.
And that's the thing where we can have hope as we look at the causes of idolatry, that God sees it and God's going to do something about it again.
Amen.
Well, there you go. We said we were going to keep it shorter. That's about 50 minutes. So it wasn't that short, but it was shorter.
Short for us.
So there we go. So there's loads to think about there. Enjoy talking about it in community. And as ever, like, you know, if there's interesting stuff coming up or questions, like grab us on Sundays, look for us, talk to us. And next week we're into Habakkuk's Psalm. So it'll be like a sort of shift of gears as we do the last little
Now
bit.
We can celebrate.
Yeah.
God's faithfulness.
Yes. Yeah, be interesting. So have a good week.